This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 23rd of January, these are our main stories. Could the Saudi crown prince have been involved in hacking the phone of the Amazon founder, Jeff Bezos? That's what new information is suggesting, according to two United Nations experts. President Trump's impeachment trial is in its second day, with the Democrats formally opening their case against him. And it's not an international public health emergency yet. The World Health Organization says it needs more information about the new respiratory virus in China. Also in this podcast, how teachers in northern Kenya deal with the trauma of repeated attacks by Islamist bandits.
We were crying and they started telling us, why are you crying? Others are dead, you arrive. You shouldn't be happy.
And are the Grammys just a boys' club? That's what the woman who was in charge of the awards said after she was suspended. United Nations experts say they've seen evidence to support claims that the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, may have been involved in hacking a phone belonging to the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. They say the hack may have been an attempt to influence coverage of Saudi Arabia in the Washington Post, which is also owned by Mr. Bezos. One of the paper's journalists, Jamal Khashoggi, was murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN investigators described today's allegations as relevant to claims that the crown prince was involved in his death. The Saudi foreign minister has dismissed the allegations as absurd. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
This is a story with everything from sex to phone hacking to the world's richest man and the allegedly sinister hand of an all-powerful Saudi prince. UN human rights investigators say they are gravely concerned by a detailed report alleging that Saudi Arabia's crown prince Mohammed bin Salman hacked into the phone of multi-billionaire Jeff Bezos, chief executive of Amazon and owner of the Washington Post. The report, compiled by Mr. Bezos' security consultants, claims that in May 2018, the prince sent Mr. Bezos a WhatsApp message containing an infected video that allowed huge quantities of his private data to then be extracted without his knowledge. Some of that data included intimate text messages and photographs relating to an extramarital affair Mr. Bezos was having, details of which emerged last year in a US tabloid newspaper, whose owner is said to be close to the Saudi crown prince. Saudi Arabia has been quick to dismiss the story. This was the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan, speaking in Davos today.
Well, I think absurd is exactly the right word. The idea that the crown prince would hack Jeff Bezos' phone is absolutely silly. And my understanding of the UN report, it's not actually a report, it's a statement based on a report by a private company that has not been vetted by any independent agency, and that has, in its own conclusions, no hard evidence to substantiate the claims it's making.
So why would the Saudi crown prince be interested in the contents of Jeff Bezos's phone? After all, the two men had enjoyed a friendly dinner together in Hollywood during the prince's US visit. The answer is that Bezos owns the Washington Post, which was publishing articles by the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi that were increasingly critical of the crown prince. 5 months after the alleged hacking, Saudi government agents murdered Mr. Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Today, the UN investigators released a statement saying,
"At a time when Saudi Arabia was supposedly investigating the killing of Mr. Khashoggi and prosecuting those it deemed responsible, it was clandestinely waging a massive online campaign against Mr. Bezos and Amazon, targeting him principally as the owner of the Washington Post."
None of this, say the Saudis, amounts to evidence, but it does renew a deep-rooted belief in the West that Saudi Arabia's crown prince is personally implicated in the suppression of all dissent, both at home and abroad.
Frank Gardner. The World Health Organization will not yet declare an international public health emergency over the outbreak of a new respiratory virus which has emerged in Wuhan in China. It says it needs more information. Imogen Folks is at WHO headquarters in Geneva for us.
It was never likely that the WHO would declare the new virus an international health emergency at this first meeting. Although the number of cases is rising fast, the WHO believes this is in part due to the efficiency of the health response so far. People are aware of the symptoms and are reporting them. What's more, China and its neighbours have already taken some of the measures that a health emergency might require, screening at airports and urging people in Wuhan itself, where the virus originated, to wear face masks in public places. Nevertheless, the WHO's decision is not final. The spread of this virus and the severity of its impact on health will be watched carefully.
In China, according to official figures, there have been 17 deaths and some 500 confirmed cases. This, the authorities' advice to the public.
The Wuhan government advice is basically, if there is no urgent need, outsiders should not visit Wuhan. Wuhan residents should not leave Wuhan unless there are special circumstances. This way, we can reduce the flow of people, reduce the possibility of contagion, and prevention and control can be successful.
But what's it like to live in a city in lockdown? David Wilmot is a Belgian who's run a bar in Wuhan for 20 years, experiencing the SARS crisis as well as the current coronavirus outbreak. He flew out of the city on Wednesday.
Everybody is in kind of panic mode, and people who dare to come outside all wear masks. Shopping malls are abandoned. Streets are quite empty. The slow trains from Wuhan, they are all being cancelled. So only the high-speed trains left Wuhan. A friend of mine had a ticket for one of these. They got a phone call, don't show up at the railway station because your train will not come and for sure not leave. I booked a ticket 2 months ago for a holiday. So I was kind of lucky that I left Wuhan at 7 o'clock when I arrived at the airport. Everybody checked their temperature outside the airport before you walk in. If you make temperature, you were taken immediately to quarantine. Every staff at the entire airport and on the plane was wearing masks.
David Wilmot talking to the BBC. Now to Washington and the second day of President Trump's impeachment trial. The Democrats have begun presenting their arguments. Their team leader, Adam Schiff, said the president had clearly abused his powers and obstructed justice in his dealings with Ukraine.
When a president wields power in ways that are inappropriate and seek to extinguish the rights of the Congress, he exceeds the power of his constitutional authority and violates the limits placed on his conduct. Obstruction of a separate and co-equal branch of government for the purposes of covering up an abuse of power not only implies a corrupt intent, but also demonstrates a remarkable antipathy towards the balance of power contemplated and enshrined in our Constitution. It is a betrayal of the president's sacred oath of office and of his duty to put the country before himself.
Just a reminder, day one of the trial saw Democratic prosecutors clashing with Mr. Trump's lawyers over the process itself, while Republicans rejected Democratic demands for more witnesses to be called. Donald Trump is, of course, accused by Democrats on two counts, one of abusing his power and the second of obstructing Congress. He's the third US president to face an impeachment trial. Earlier on Wednesday, at a news conference in Davos, where he's attending the meeting of the World Economic Forum, Mr. Trump again dismissed the impeachment trial, attacking key Democrats.
It's a disgrace. They talked about their tremendous case, and it's all done, their tremendous case. They had no case. It's all a hoax. It's a con job, like Schiff. He's a corrupt politician. Now, I'll leave that to the Senate. The Senate's going to have to answer that. I have great respect for the Senate as a body and many of the individuals. I have great respect. So I'll leave that to the Senate. But this is the greatest witch hunt.
I asked our correspondent on Capitol Hill, Gary O'Donoghue, if what we're hearing in the Senate is a replay of what we'd heard earlier in the House of Representatives.
Yes, I think it is, in large part. I mean, they gathered a lot of testimony. You remember they had a couple of dozen witnesses, hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents and text messages and emails and all that kind of thing. And they are going to go over that in narrative form. They're going to try and add in some other stuff that's appeared since the end of the impeachment investigation and the votes to impeach the president in December as well. Some other details that have emerged over the last few weeks, particularly those surrounding these Ukrainian businessmen that were involved with Rudy Giuliani. But also you're hearing much more clearly, and Adam Schiff articulated this in his opening statement there, the sort of specific argument aimed at the senators, which is, you need to make sure you hear all the evidence, and that includes getting documents from the White House that have been withheld up until now, getting witnesses that have been withheld up until now. And if you don't do that, then this will amount to a cover-up and to an unfair trial. So they're doing the detail, if you like, of the allegation, but they're also doing this big picture argument about the nature of the trial that's being gone through.
Yeah, well, we know the Republicans are blocking that at the moment. No fresh evidence, no witnesses. Will the Democrats get another chance at bringing forward new evidence and witnesses potentially?
Nick, they will. I mean, they had 11 shots at it yesterday and failed on each occasion, votes down party lines. But they will get another crack at it probably at the end of next week. I mean, that's in the schedule for a period of debate and votes on witnesses and documents. What they need is four Republicans to switch sides, four Republicans to come over and say, yeah, actually, we believe we ought to hear from these people and see these documents.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. When wildfires were in the news recently, they were mostly in relatively warm places such as southern Australia and California. But last summer, fires also burned as far north as the Arctic Circle in Siberia. The problem is not new there, but climate experts say it's getting worse because of global warming. And residents have prepared themselves for the coming warm season. This report from Vitaly Shevchenko.
That was a Russian army helicopter flying low over the Siberian forest. The troops were coming to firefight because in the summer of 2019, the trees were burning. Forests of pine, spruce and birch were lost. And where there was no fire, there was suffocating smoke.
In the summer, everyone tries to go on holiday and flying is the only option. Due to the smoke, we can take off on time. We can go out for a walk with the children, go to the river that we love.
That was Alexander Karnaukhov, a PE teacher from the village of Vanovara, more than 3,500 kilometres from Moscow. Behind him, almost lost in the smoke, a boat made its way down the Podkamennaya Tunguska River. The BBC's Oksana Chizh travelled to Vanovara as the fires raged and spoke to a local doctor, Lyudmila Blagova, about the health problems they were causing.
There are 6 to 10 people calling for ambulance every day, 6 of them with breathing difficulties or heart problems. 2 or 3 of them are children, but adults tend to present with bigger reactions.
Wildfires are a fact of life in Siberian summers, but 2019 was the second worst on record. The head of the firefighting team at Greenpeace Russia, Grigory Kuksin, is convinced that global warming is making them worse. Climate change has happened. Fire seasons are no longer, he told me. Mark Parrington from the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts monitored conditions over Siberia.
For the Arctic Circle part, to begin with, it was very unusual that we would see fires from June in such a large-ish number and persisting for 2 to 3 months in that part of the world. And then outside of the Arctic Circle, I think the data that we have shows that the total emissions for the summer were higher than the previous 16 years of data that we have in our data set.
Timber is one of the main industries in Vanovara. In the smoke, the men wore face masks as they chopped huge logs ready for transportation. The colder winter hasn't turned the fires into distant memory. Alexander Zarubin, the Vanovara village chief, told me by telephone that local people were prepared for the next dry season.
By and large, this is business as usual for us. People have accepted it. I know that this is very inconvenient and some have had their health affected. But for most people, this is just how things are because of the weather. There is no panic and no one is thinking of leaving. This is how it was in the previous years. And looking ahead, I don't think there'll be any panic either.
Back in the summer, a local farmer took a moment to strum his guitar and praise the beauty of the local landscape. But he said his potato crop had been destroyed by the weather. The Kremlin is unwilling to be drawn on how much global warming is to blame for Siberia's more frequent fires. and how they might affect such isolated communities. For now, the people of Vannevara are determined to be resilient.
Vitaly Shevchenko. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, how a billionaire's generosity may help Zimbabwean doctors to get paid in a stable currency, albeit only for a time. He was once one of Hollywood's most decorated and lauded executives, but since 2017, more than 80 women have accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual misconduct, allegations which helped drive the Me Too movement. Now, Mr. Weinstein is in court for the start of his trial in New York. He's accused of rape and sexual assault by two women. He's denied the claim, saying the two encounters which happened in 2006 and 2013 were consensual. Noda Torfik, our correspondent in New York, told us what charges against him were outlined in court.
Harvey Weinstein is charged with raping one woman in a hotel room in 2013. Now, she had originally been unidentified, but in court for the first time, we heard her name and a little bit more about her situation. She was an aspiring actress from a farm in Washington State who left home at 16 and moved to Los Angeles at 25. Prosecutors outlined in their opening arguments how she felt blessed that she had met Harvey Weinstein because she thought he could give her a leg up in the industry and help her. But essentially what they said is that he ended up having a long relationship with her where he sexually assaulted her, made her feel suicidal, made her believe that she could only continue seeing him if she didn't want to harm her career. And they say that ended in rape at a hotel in New York in 2013 and then rape again 8 months later. And they also accuse Harvey Weinstein of forcing oral sex on a second woman in his apartment in 2016. And that woman, Mimi Halei, has actually gone out publicly in 2017 with her attorney, Gloria Allred, to outline that situation, saying, again, she had no desire for any kind of relationship with Harvey Weinstein, made it clear, but that he forced himself on her. I should also just note that prosecutors put up the pictures of these women when they were speaking to the jury and outlining in very graphic detail what happened to them. They also put up the pictures of four other women who are going to basically also testify to show a pattern, they say, that Harvey Weinstein was a sexual predator.
Mr. Weinstein would face life in prison if he's found guilty on these charges. What is the defense likely to argue?
Well, we've heard from the defense today in court as well during opening arguments. They say that these were consensual relationships, that they have emails that will show that one of the women wanted Harvey Weinstein to have her new number and to meet her mother. So it was a very consensual situation.
Noda Torfik in New York. The Somali-based Islamist Al-Shabaab group has carried out six attacks in Kenya in the last 5 weeks alone, killing more than two dozen people. In the Garissa region in the northeast of the country, three teachers and three students died in attacks. And now, fearful teachers say that they want to leave the area. The government insists that it strengthens security. Ferdinand Amondi reports from Garissa.
Lucy counts herself incredibly lucky to be alive, and she is. Few have been raided by the dreaded Al-Shabaab militants and lived to tell the story. One night in January, Lucy recalls the disruptive sound of automatic rifles ripping through the silence of a school residence. She says she crawled under a bed, tightly holding her baby. They survived the night with two female colleagues. Three others in a separate room were killed. Lucy fights back tears as she recounts the ordeal.
When the villagers came, they told us some of their teachers and we were crying. And they started telling us, why are you crying? Others are dead, you arrive. God has saved you, you shouldn't be happy. But due to the trauma that we went, I would not like to be in that area anymore. Furthermore, I'm traumatized. Our colleagues are dead. I can't go in an institution where I was in the same staff with my teachers, with my fellow teachers, and they are no more.
Kamuthe Primary School ought to be among the safest schools in Garissa. It is located some 200 kilometers from the Somali border. It also had a manned police post. But Al-Shabaab raided both the school and the police post, setting the post on fire. That attack sparked fear among public servants across the region. At the regional offices of the Teacher Service Commission in Garissa, teachers flock daily, bags packed and ready to move. Many have requested to be moved to other parts of the country. However, the Teacher Service Commission is instead shuffling most of them from one school to another within Garissa County. Andrew Mwandhi is the teacher's regional director.
We have already a shortage of teachers in this particular county. So if we move them out of the county, then we will be creating a national crisis, leave alone a county crisis. All kind of officers are here for security. So these fears, some of these fears, may be exaggerated by the teachers. However, we also need to put ourselves in their shoes, and we are organizing for counseling services to talk to these particular teachers.
Not many would call this response satisfactory, but the government is caught up in a delicate balancing act. I'm now walking along one of Garissa's main streets, and it's business as usual. Motorcycle riders are providing transport services, moving people from one end to another. The fruit vendors selling pawpaw, oranges, and very sweet watermelon. I can see a bank and people lining up at the ATM, and the distance is a hospital. Now, here in Garissa, more than half of the people who provide these essential services are from other parts of Kenya. And yet, these are the people who feel like they are the primary targets of Al-Shabaab. And many of them, especially teachers, doctors and nurses, want to leave. And that's a problem for the Kenya government, because if they want to leave, then the essential services they provide will be threatened. The government has sent teams made up of military and special police forces to fight Al-Shabaab in the frontier areas bordering Somalia. But more than 26 people have died in the 6 militant attacks since December. Many Kenyans living and working in these frontier areas are beginning to question their safety. Samuel Njuguna is the Deputy County Commissioner in Garissa.
The war on terror is very dynamic, and Al-Shabaab was able to manipulate and do whatever they are doing in the county. Garissa's account is quite huge, almost 46,000 square kilometers. And though we have a lot of presence of security agencies from Kenya Defense Forces, special forces and specialized units, police, those issues have happened within the county. To win war, terror and terrorism will require all efforts of each and everybody, from the community level, local populations and the security agencies.
Sam Njuguna, the Deputy Commissioner of Garissa, ending that report by Ferdinand Amondi. Hospitals in Zimbabwe are short of many essential things. Medical equipment, a reliable electricity supply, and for the last 4 months, even doctors. They've been on strike because they want the government to pay them in US dollars rather than the rapidly devaluing local currency. Now a benefactor has stepped in to get them back to work. Here's the Zimbabwean telecoms billionaire Strive Masiyiwa. He's going to pay each doctor a salary of about $300 a month. Dr. Tawanda Tsvakada from the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association has been speaking about what it was like to return to work.
Well, it's mixed feelings, you know. At the same time that I'm happy to be back, to be able to finish my internship and training. But at this other end, there isn't enough equipment for us to be able to provide maximum and quality service to our patients. Lives were lost, and others had deformities which will never be recovered. Unfortunately, as doctors, we couldn't do much about that. It's solely for the government to look into that issue.
Shigai Nyoka is our correspondent in Harare. I asked her how long the doctors are going to be paid for.
That's the caveat. Despite the fact that Strive Masiyiwa's family foundation has set aside about $6 million in what they call a medical training completion fellowship, this program will only last for 6 months. So it's not clear what will happen. This offer was made in December, early December, in fact, and the doctors had been reluctant to accept it precisely because they said it was a short-term offer and that negotiations with government are still going on to find a long-term solution to this.
It is rather embarrassing for the government having a private individual stepping in to pay the doctors. What chance is there that it's going to agree to what the doctors want and pay in dollars?
The government isn't embarrassed. In fact, they've actually welcomed the move as part of what they say is private-public partnerships required to weather the economic storm that Zimbabwe is going through. They had offered to increase not just doctors, but civil service wages across the board, which would have seen the doctors' salaries double. But the doctors are arguing that as long as salaries are not pegged in a stable currency like the US dollar, they'll be eroded by inflation. But the government is arguing that they can't be seen to be favoring the doctors. They have a whole civil service, including teachers, potentially soldiers and police, who are all agitating for salaries to be pegged to a stable currency. And so they say that they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Shinga Nyoka in Harare. In a few days, the Grammy Awards will take place in Los Angeles, but the ceremony could be overshadowed by a series of complaints. They were filed by the woman in charge of the awards. Deborah Duggan was suspended from her role, and she's now describing the Grammys as a boys' club network where men work together to the disadvantage of women. Officials have questioned why she waited until she'd been suspended to make her allegations. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Deborah Duggan took over as the first female boss of the Grammys 5 months ago. She has now filed a sexual harassment and discrimination complaint against her employers and also claims that voting for the Grammys is ripe with corruption. Her allegations come days after she was suspended from her role for what the Grammys called misconduct. Deborah Duggan says that was an act of retaliation for an email she had sent to the head of HR outlining serious allegations about the organisation. These ranged from the Grammy nominations being manipulated if they wanted a certain act to perform on the show, to their own lawyers having conflicts of interest. The Grammys have responded by saying that they believe it's curious Deborah Duggan didn't raise these allegations until claims of bullying were made against her by her own assistant. This is someone who, in the lawsuit, Ms. Duggan says was spying on her for the other members of the board. Her lawyers say the bullying allegations are completely false. They add that the Grammys offered her millions of dollars to drop her claims and walk away.
Colin Patterson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.